What does it mean to be a good Muslim?
One of the questions that the good Muslim tries to answer is, how do people become extremists? I suppose on the one hand, I wanted to make Soheil a sympathetic character. I wanted to give him a real reason for turning to religion. I wanted to give him a real moral conflict. And his choice is a moral choice. However, I also didn't want to shy away from really talking about the dangers of extremism.
That's novelist Tamima Annam. In 2008, we spoke to her about her acclaimed debut novel, A Golden Age. It was about one family's experience in the Bangladesh struggle for independence from Pakistan. Now, Annam is back with a terrific sequel. It's called The Good Muslim. We'll hear both interviews today on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Tamima Annam's first novel, A Golden Age, told the story of the widow Rehana Haq and her two teenage children as they become involved in Bangladesh's struggle for independence. The Liberation War was an armed conflict that pitted East Pakistan and India against West Pakistan. The war ended in the secession of East Pakistan, which became the independent nation of Bangladesh. It was a brutal conflict, with many of the features that have become typical of modern civil war, including mass rape and the targeting of civilians. The fight was about more than political independence. It was also about democracy versus dictatorship, language, and religion. Annam's first book showed how becoming active in the struggle changed the widow Rehana Haq. Now, in her new novel, The Good Muslim, she explores what happened to Rehana's children, Maya and Soheil, how the War of Independence changed them, and how they each deal so differently with the trauma of war that has been seared into their souls. Tamima Annam was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, in 1975. She was raised in Paris, New York City, and Bangkok, and went to school at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. Her first novel, A Golden Age, won the 2008 Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Book. Tamima Annam, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the first time we spoke with you, we spoke to you about your debut novel, The Golden Age, and in it you tell the story of a widow with two teenage children and how the family becomes involved in Bangladesh's struggle for independence. When we talked to you about that in 2008, you told us you wanted to see how war changed people, and you focused very much on the widow, Rehana Haq. Now in this new novel, The Good Muslim, the story begins 7 years after independence has been won, and it puts a focus more on the adult children, Maya and Soheil. Let's start with Maya. Tell us about her.
Well, Maya is kind of inspired by a lot of people I met in Bangladesh who were young women when the war broke out. And as many women in war, they were allowed to do things because it was that sort of situation that they would never have been allowed to do otherwise. So, you know, Maya in the war, she drives an ambulance, she works in a refugee camp, she joins a political movement, and she calls other people comrade. So it's a kind of moment of liberation for her. And as a result, when the war is over, she really takes her fate into her own hands, and she decides she's going to sort of abandon convention. She's not going to marry, and she's going to be a doctor. And so she goes into the villages, she leaves home, and she's basically a sort of charismatic, progressive, and she's a feminist as well. She's very politically self-conscious.
And she's marked by the war.
Absolutely. She and her brother both, although they're very young, and because they're very young when the war breaks out, they're so influenced by that. And she has all these memories of these traumatic things that she has seen. So she comes out of the war, and the way she copes with it is by throwing herself into the service of her country. And her brother, also coping with this trauma of war, with things he's seen, and also because he's a soldier, with things he's done, he clings to his faith. He needs a moral scaffolding, and he chooses his faith.
Now, when the novel starts out, The Good Muslim, Maya is just coming home after 7 years away. Tell us where she's been and what she's been doing.
Well, Maya leaves home because she's really upset when, after the war, her brother turns to religion. And it's sort of difficult to imagine why someone would leave home on that account, but she's so afraid of what religion can do to people because the war that she's just fought was fought kind of on the basis of this, you know, this contest over what it means to be Muslim, which is, you know, when Bangladesh, what used to be East Pakistan, when it became independent, that war had a lot to do with these kinds of issues of identity. So she's really upset when her brother turns to religion, and she leaves home, and she becomes a doctor, and she calls herself a lady doctor. And to her, that means she goes to very remote areas where women don't have access to healthcare, and she treats them, and mostly she helps children come into the world safely.
But she wasn't always helping children come into the world. Do you want to talk a little bit about the, and this is something that, that really happened during the war, the rapes, the mass rapes of women?
Yes, so Maya, after the war is over, people discovered that, in fact, the Pakistan army had conducted a campaign of sexual violence against Bangladeshi civilians. Oftentimes, they would kidnap women from their homes and had kept them as, basically, as, you know, prisoner for the whole 9 months of the war. And when these women are released, when the war is over, many of them are pregnant. And there's a kind of national mood, you know, spurred by the prime minister, the leader of the independence movement, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, and he says, we must embrace these women. But he doesn't want to embrace their children because they are the product of rape. So there are a lot. There's a lot of pressure for these women to abort their babies. And Maya, she comes out of the war, and she wants to serve her country, and she's told that, in fact, she's doing something for the greater good. And she helps, assists in a lot of these abortions. But over time, she starts to feel incredibly guilty about these. So as she gets older, part of her crusade or campaign for helping babies come into the world safely, you know, she says it's like one baby that's coming into the world, almost to put on a scale against a baby that she might have helped to abort just after the war.
A lot of the book, The New Muslim, is about how people process the trauma that they've gone through. You've talked about how Maya is doing it. Tell us how Sohail, I mean, already we know that he has turned religious. What was he like before? What kind of a change is this for him? And why has he turned to religion?
I suppose one of the questions that the good Muslim tries to answer is, how do people become extremists? And I wanted to give Sohail a real reason for turning to his faith. Now, he takes it too far, but at first he turns to his faith because he's really lost, and before the war, he's this really attractive revolutionary, and he has a very romantic sense of himself. And when the war is over, he's kind of lost that sense of himself, and he is sort of addicted to that idea that he's going to throw himself into a movement or having an identity that's to do with more than just his individual life. And so he's kind of defeated by the ordinariness of life as a citizen, and he wants something more. So he turns to his faith, first because it gives him a way to make sense of the world, but then it also really fits in with his character, which is that he needs some kind of, you know, some kind of movement or some kind of idea to throw himself into. And it becomes, that's why he takes it as far as he does.
And therein lies the conflict between him and his sister. I love how in this book, The Good Muslim, well, I think there are some sides you take. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that you're not an advocate of fundamentalist extremism. It's a very nuanced book. There's great ambivalence and humanity to the characters in spite of their flaws. Could you talk a little bit about the dynamic that goes on between Maya and Sohail?
Well, you know, part of the reason I wrote this book and gave this particular title is that there are contestations and debates within Muslim communities about what it means to be a Muslim. It's not just a conversation that people from the outside are having with these communities. So there's a wide variety of religious practice in any Muslim society, and especially in a place like Bangladesh, where for the most part people are very devout, but they have never wanted Islam to be part of their political identity. And extremism is very marginalized. So, you know, Maya is a person that you would meet in Bangladesh, an avid secularist. She doesn't really relate to her, the Islamic side of her identity. And then there's Sohail, for whom it takes over everything. But also there's the character of the mother, and she's kind of balancing between the two because for her, Islam is a big part of her identity. She practices, you know, she prays every day, but it's not the only identity. And she's a little bit older, and she's lived a long and complicated life, so she can really have a balanced sense of herself, whereas maybe her children in this fiery, youthful, post-revolutionary passion feel that they either have to fully embrace or fully reject this idea of faith.
Why does Maya need to have her brother be more like herself?
That's a really interesting question. Why do we need any of our loved ones to be like us? I suppose for her, you know, she and her brother grew up in this political movement together, and part of that movement was about rejecting religion because that is why they were in the conflict in the first place.
And could you explain that a little bit more?
Of course, yes. So Bangladesh used to be called East Pakistan. It was a district or a branch of Pakistan, the Pakistan that we know today. And if you look at a map, it was a very odd country because the two wings of Pakistan were, you know, they were sandwiching this huge swath of land, which was India. And the only reason they were constructed as one country was that they had a higher population of Muslims in those regions of India. So when the British left, it was East and West Pakistan, and it was India. But this country didn't make any sense. You know, I mean, you can't govern a country that's divided by 1,000 miles of hostile, which at the time, India and Pakistan, you know, hostile territory. Plus, Bengalis in East Pakistan and Punjabis in West Pakistan, they had nothing in common. They had no language in common. They had no real culture in common. And there was religion, but people practice Islam in very different ways, as we know, all over the world. So for Maya, I mean, when they fought this war, they were saying religion is not enough to have a national identity. In fact, we are Bengali, we speak Bengali, we have this other culture, and that's who we are. So Maya and Sohail grow up in this movement, and they really reject religion. And in fact, there's a moment in the novel when the mother sees how traumatized her son is when he comes back from war, and he's restless and really upset, and he can't sleep, and she reads to him from the Quran. Because for her, the Quran is a book that has given her a lot of solace in her life. And he says, no, I don't want to hear that. You know, religion is not what I'm about. But of course, he slowly, slowly gets involved, and we know what happens.
And he becomes a religious leader, not just religious himself. So I'd like you to talk about that and also what that means for him as a father, because I think this is a part that I was most troubled by, in the sense that one gets involved with a character and, you know, wants to like a character. Here he has a son who he utterly neglects. How does this work?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose on the one hand, I wanted to make Sohail a sympathetic character. I wanted to give him a real reason for turning to religion. I wanted to give him a real moral conflict, and his choice is a moral choice. However, I also didn't want to shy away from really talking about the dangers of extremism. And in this case, it's not a political danger, it's a very intimate danger, which is that he completely neglects his family. And first he rejects his sister and his mother, and he turns away from everyone and has a kind of ascetic idea of himself. But then the victim is his son. He believes that his son is being raised in a kind of religious environment, and you know, he doesn't think of himself as just a father to his one child. He thinks of himself as a leader of the whole congregation. So why should he single out this one child? And ultimately, he sends his son to be educated in a madrasa. And that's really when the conflict between Maya and Sohail comes to a head, because that's the moment when Maya realizes that, in fact, although she had really hoped for a reconciliation with her brother, perhaps that's not possible.
And we're speaking with Tamima Annan about her book, The Good Muslim. The other question I have is that there's a kind of miracle that happens in the book, a kind of miracle of faith, very much connected to faith. And I don't want to ruin the story by saying what it is, so unless you feel free to talk about it. But if you don't want to reveal it, without doing so, could you discuss why you chose to have a miracle of faith occur, a miraculous thing occur?
Well, I suppose I really wanted Maya to be challenged over the course of the story. And she spends the whole time kind of ridiculing her brother and pushing him away because she thinks his religion, his faith, is slightly ridiculous. And she's angry about it and she thinks it's deeply irrational. But her mother becomes very ill in the book and she finds herself captivated by the possibility that there may be some other way for her mother to get better, some way that's not just the medical way, because she's a doctor. So her first instinct is to say, okay, this is a medical problem, we can solve it. But her mother gets sicker and sicker, and she finds herself needing something else to believe in. And I wanted her beliefs to be challenged, that maybe her kind of scientific view of the world is not the only thing, the only piece of the puzzle, you know. So I don't want to give away what happens, but she definitely finds a reason to doubt herself, to doubt her kind of rational, non-religious beliefs.
Is this a struggle that you've struggled with? Did you grow up as a Muslim or secular?
Well, I grew up in a very secular family because, like Maya, my parents had, you know, participated in this war, and, I didn't really get any religious instruction when I was growing up. But like many of us, I feel, you know, I'm curious about religion, and I think that at some point in every person's life, people ask themselves this question, which is that, is there something I'm missing here? Is there something I'm not getting because I have, you know, believed one thing my whole life? Is it possible that something else is out there for me? So I think it's definitely something that I wonder about. And, you know, the global conversation about Islam is very complicated now. So on the one hand, I feel very angry at some of the people, Muslims, who get attention in the world, the ones who I can relate to the least in terms of their politics and their beliefs. On the other hand, I think Islam gets a really bad rap, so I feel a little bit protective. I'm a Muslim, my family are all Muslims, you know, and for the most, and everybody I know, you know, in Bangladesh is Muslim, and yet none of them believe in any of the sort of violent and regressive and hateful things that we often hear about Islam. So I think, in a way, the book was a way for me to try to maybe relate to the religion, and I read the Quran and learned a lot about it because I wanted Sohail to have a real basis for getting into his faith. And I learned a lot as a result.
The title, The Good Muslim, all along as I read this book, Tamima Annan, I was thinking that the good Muslim must be Sohail, Maya's brother, who is this religious fundamentalist. By the end of the book, I thought that the good Muslim was, in fact, Maya.
The title is meant sort of as a provocation. And I'm really glad that you had that response because I want every reader to ask themselves, who is the good Muslim? I mean, all the characters in the book believe that they are the good Muslim, including Rehana, the mother, and Maya in her way. They all believe that they are working towards a kind of moral good. But the book isn't really meant to answer that question. You know, you go back and forth. In fact, when Sohail first reveals himself as religious to his sister, she's the fundamentalist because she doesn't believe that there's any way that she can embrace her brother's new need for his faith. But as the story goes on, there are some very terrible consequences to Sohail's extremism.
Yes, but also to Maya's in a way, or let's just say Maya's attempts to do good end up with tragic consequences. It seems that this is actually a theme that really transcends religion. It's something that we all struggle with, the terrible consequences that can come from the best intentions, just the way the luck of the draw is, the accidents of life, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. So how do you put this together? I mean, in terms of the ending of the book, which we won't reveal, it's a sad ending. I think I can safely say that. It's sad. It's provocative. It makes one really think. What were you trying to leave the reader with here?
Well, like I was saying before, I think I really wanted to talk about how these different conflicting worldviews play out within the intimate space of a family, and particularly the dangers of ideology and the dangers of extremism. The reason the ending is sad is because there has to be a kind of reckoning. When a person abandons everything and sticks to this very strict kind of moral code that doesn't leave room for real human relationships, there has to be a reckoning. And it was really important to me to make that point. So I suppose, you know, we have these debates and conversations in the abstract sometimes, but really it's families that sometimes pay the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually I should correct that. The very ending is not sad. In fact, it's in some ways triumphant. And you end on a very forward-looking note, not just for this family that we've become so attached to, but also for the country, Bangladesh. Where is Bangladesh now?
Well, you don't hear a lot about Bangladesh because it is neither as successful as India or as troubled as Pakistan. And yet, in its quiet way, Bangladesh has been making a lot of progress. And we've remained a secular, moderate Muslim country with 2 decades of steady democracy. So I think the future is good for Bangladesh if we can have good leaders who are not corrupt, which, as you know, in some countries, in all countries, that's sometimes a lot to ask for.
Finally, did you have any challenges in writing this book, or do you have challenges in writing in general? Or would you like to talk about your process of writing?
Well, I think it's the thing with a novel is it's so long and takes such a long time to write that inevitably there are highs and lows. And I think second novels can also be particularly difficult because I didn't have the bravado of the first one. I was kind of painfully aware of all the things that I had done wrong that I wanted to improve on. You know, you always want to get better at your craft and learn things. So it was a slightly slower process. But also, I think for me, the biggest challenge was trying to make Sohail a real person, a real three-dimensional character, and not just a kind of mullah who we can reject. And so that took a lot of work for me, not just reading about Islam and learning about the process that one might take when converting to Islam or you know, moving towards Islam, or for Sohail it was like a rebirth, but also making that believable and making his extremism also believable in some way, even though, of course, he doesn't get off easily in the book.
Well, the book is The Good Muslim. We've been speaking with Tamima Anam. It's a beautifully, beautifully written book, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's been a real pleasure to be on the program.
Tamima Anam's writing has been published in Granta, The New York Times, and The Guardian. Her first novel, A Golden Age, won the 2008 Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best First Book. It was translated into 22 languages. Stay tuned for our 2008 interview with her about A Golden Age after the break. But first, our next segment visits the poetry of the great Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore. When I was growing up, the works of the great Indian Bangladeshi poet Rabindranath Tagore graced the bookshelves of my parents' library. I was always enchanted by his musical name, and later by the beauty of his poetry. I'll read a few short poems he wrote that are very apt to the subject of today's show. But first, here's a little about his life from the website eTakana, Great Personalities of Bangladesh. Rabindranath Tagore, mystic, painter, and Nobel laureate for literature, is among the leading personalities of modern Bangladesh and India. He was born in Calcutta on May 7, 1861, and was the youngest of 14 children. His father, Debendranath Tagore, was a Sanskrit scholar, and Rabindranath's early education was imparted at home. In school, while others learned their lessons, he would slip into the more exciting world of dreams. He wrote his first poem when he was barely seven. At the age of 17, his first book of poems was published. Tagore was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1913 for his collection of poems Gitanjali. He was knighted by the ruling British government in 1915, but within a few years he resigned the honor as a protest against British policies in India. Rabindranath Tagore had early success as a writer in his native Bengal. With the translations of some of his poems, he became rapidly known in the West. In fact, his fame attained a luminous height, taking him across continents on lecture tours and tours of friendship. For the world, he became the voice of present Bangladesh and India's spiritual heritage. Especially for Bengal, he became a great living institution. That's from the website eTakana, Great Personalities of Bangladesh. Here's Rabindranath Tagore's poem, Leave This. It's from the poetry collection, Gitanjali. It draws a line between the outward trappings of religion and the spirit the poet sees everywhere. Leave this. Leave this chanting and singing and telling of beads. Whom dost thou worship in this lonely dark corner of a temple with doors all shut? Open thine eyes and see thy God is not before thee. He is there where the tiller is tilling the hard ground and where the pathmaker is breaking stones. He is with them in sun and in shower, and his garment is covered with dust. Put off thy holy mantle, and even like him, come down on the dusty soil. That's the poem, Leaves This, by Rabindranath Tagore. And here's the poem, Mind Without Fear. It's a prayer for freedom, both personal and political. Mind without fear. Where the mind is without fear and the head is held high, where knowledge is free, where the world has not been broken up into fragments by narrow domestic walls, where words come out from the depth of truth, where tireless striving stretches its arms toward perfection, where the clear stream of reason has not lost its way into the dreary desert sand of dead habit, where the mind is led forward by thee into ever-widening thought and action. Into that heaven of freedom, my Father, let my country awake. That was the poem, Mind Without Fear. You heard before that the poem. They were written and translated into English by Rabindranath Tagore, the great writer and mystic of India and Bangladesh. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And here's a shout-out to WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, the newest station to put Writer's Voice on its schedule. WPKN is a great community radio station that's been serving Southern Connecticut and Eastern Long Island for a long, long time. I'm proud that Writer's Voice has been chosen for its lineup. All you supporters of community radio can help the station out right now during its fall fundraiser. Just go to WPKN.org to find out how. Next up, we hear my 2008 interview with novelist Tamima Anam about her acclaimed debut novel, A Golden Age. It's the first of her two works of... It's the first of her two books about a family that is changed by Bangladesh's struggle for independence. Stay tuned after the break. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next up, we hear my 2008 interview with novelist Tamima Annam about her acclaimed debut novel, A Golden Age. It's the first of her two books about a family that is changed by Bangladesh's struggle for independence. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In our first segment today, we talked with Tamima Annam about her new novel, The Good Muslim. Now, we'll take you back to our 2008 interview with her about her first novel, A Golden Age. It begins the story that is continued in her latest book, the story of the widow Rahana Haque and her children Maya and Sohail, as they all become drawn into Bangladesh's struggle for independence. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. When Tamima Annam went back to her native Bangladesh to do research for her doctoral thesis in anthropology, she gathered testimony from scores of survivors of Bangladesh's 1971 War of Independence from Pakistan. The conflict occurred 4 years before she was born, and she left the country at the age of two, living in Europe and America, and eventually attending Mount Holyoke College in Western Massachusetts. Her novel, A Golden Age, returns to Bangladesh's struggle to become independent to tell the story of one family, a mother and her two children, both on the brink of adulthood. Rahana Haque is drawn by her children into the struggle, partly to pay off a decade-old debt to them. A debt incurred, Rahana feels, when she had to give them up for several years while they were still quite small, after she was widowed. The novel is a sensitive foray into the bonds of family and patriotism in the best sense of the word, and how the two intersect. Associate producer Michael Pollitt and I spoke with Tamima Annam last week. Her book is The Golden Age. Tamima Annam, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, in your book, your novel, A Golden Age, this is the story of a family living and fighting through the War of Independence for Bangladesh, which used to be part of Pakistan. Could you give us kind of a quick synopsis of how Pakistan came into being as a country that was separated? It was like two wings sitting on either side of India.
That's exactly right. What happened was that when the British left India after having colonized it for 200 years, they left behind not one but two countries, India, which was a secular republic, and Pakistan, which was based on the idea of a kind of Muslim homeland for the sort of Muslim population in the subcontinent. And it was a very oddly shaped country because it was based on demographics, on the concentration of Muslims in the area, and so there was West Pakistan on one side of India and East Pakistan on the other side of India, and these two regions were divided not only by 1,000 miles of India, but also by language, by culture, by ethnicity. So as you can imagine, this country really didn't work, and that's really why we had the Bangladesh War in 1971.
You had different languages, as you say.
Absolutely, and in fact, soon after the independence of Pakistan, Urdu was imposed as the national language of the entire country. But Urdu was not spoken by anyone in the Eastern Wing, you know, by 98% of the people in the Eastern Wing. So that was a very big sign to them from the very beginning that they weren't going to be equal partners in this nation, that they were going to always be sort of the kind of poor relation, I suppose you could say. And this kind of really kicked off the tensions between the two wings.
Now, this is also a very personal story of a mother who, as the story begins, has lost her children. I wanted to ask, why has this happened, and also is this a kind of metaphor for the larger context of the book?
Well, the Rehana losing her children, the name of the main character is Rehana Huck, it's sort of the major event of her adult life, and it really helps to explain all the decisions that she makes throughout the war and throughout the novel. Her relationship with her children is not just one of kind of maternal love and protection, but also of a sense of guilt that she feels. She says that she feels indebted to her children because she allowed them to be taken away from her. And so every time they ask her for something, she can't say no, even though it goes against her instincts. So when they ask her, can we please get involved in the war, she can't say no. And then slowly, slowly, she starts to get sucked into this movement through her kind of relationship with her children.
Tamima, in the acknowledgments in your book, you mention the many stories of the war that your parents told you.
Yes.
Now, is your novel made up of these stories? Is this in large part or a very small part about your family during this time?
Well, some of the stories are about my family. I didn't grow up in Bangladesh. My father was a diplomat with the UN, so we moved all over the world. And one of the ways that they helped me to stay connected to Bangladesh was to tell me stories about the war. And both my parents had been in the war. Their families had been very involved, all of their friends. So I did grow up listening to stories about the war. And some of those stories made it into the book. The character of Rehana is loosely based on my maternal grandmother, who was also widowed at a young age, and her house became the center of one of the centers of the resistance in the city. And, you know, if you met her, you wouldn't think that she would have been capable of being such a kind of revolutionary, but she kind of really got caught up in the movement because of her children, i.e. my mother and my mother's brother.
Now, you were born in Bangladesh.
I was.
And you left when you were two. Why did you leave, and then why did you go back?
As I said, my parents were both working for the UN, so my father first got posted to Paris. So we moved to Paris when I was only 2 years old, and then we lived in various countries. We lived in the United States for a while. We lived in Thailand, and then when I was 15, my parents decided to move back to Bangladesh because they still had that kind of spirit because they had been in the war, and they would always, no matter what country we lived in, they would always say, oh, no, you know, we're not staying here. We're going to move back to Bangladesh. It was always something that they were very keen on doing. And my father ended up starting one of the first politically neutral daily newspapers in the country, which is now a very successful English daily newspaper. So he's a journalist, a very kind of prominent figure in the media because he's been standing up to the government, and he's very outspoken. And my mother runs a human rights aid organization. So I'm very connected to Bangladesh, and I have always, even when I came to Mount Holyoke for university and went on to graduate school in Massachusetts, I always was very connected to Bangladesh, and I go home two or three times a year. And specifically to do my doctoral research on the Bangladesh War, I went home for 2 years. I traveled all over the country. I interviewed many, many survivors of the war.
What were the things that most inspired your interest in writing a novel about this that came out of the research that you did?
Well, what happened was that I went to Bangladesh thinking that I was doing a kind of oral history project. And I met so many fascinating people, and I heard so many stories, and I was so moved. I was so emotionally kind of transformed by this, by hearing these stories, and I thought, the only way that I would really be able to convey something of that tone, something of that intensity, would be to write fiction, because fiction is the, you know, the sort of method we use to transport ourselves to another time and place, and no other form of writing can really do that. So that's why I chose to write a novel.
And it's a novel that takes place during the war, but it's not really about the war. It's really about the family struggle, Rehana Huck's struggles to survive the war and to keep her family intact. You have a wonderful way of letting us know that it was a horrible war, and yet you don't concentrate on the gore of it. I wonder if that was difficult for you to do that and not try to expose the atrocities. How did you stay with a fictional account that way?
Well, I think it's very difficult to try to balance these different interests when you write a historical novel. You know, how much of the history do you provide? How much of the kind of political backdrop or the sort of, you know, journalistic instinct to describe the brutality of the war? Those are all sort of competing interests. But I really wanted to write a novel about how ordinary people survived this war. What happened to them, how they were changed, how their relationships with one another were changed. And you sort of get a sense of what's going on because various people in Rehana's life either are disappeared or they are killed. And you only see some of the violence close up when she goes to rescue this particular prisoner of war from a camp. And you sort of see what's happened to him and that he's been tortured. But that's really, I wanted to make sure that you sort of stayed in Rehana's perspective. And she was very much confined to her home and very much just concerned with saving her children. And this is really the focus of the book. Because as I said, I wanted to make the book about, not about a soldier or about a politician or about this war in a kind of abstract sense, but very specifically about this very ordinary woman and how she's kind of, how she becomes a sort of revolutionary through her experiences in this war.
Tell us more about Rehana. Tell us more about her character and her struggles and how being a mother is so involved with her decision to become part of the resistance. You alluded to that before, but tell us more about that.
Well, Rehana is, I mean, one of the main things about her is that she's actually not from Bangladesh. She's from Calcutta, which means that she speaks Urdu, and that makes her a bit of an outsider. And the reason I did that was because I actually thought the novel was going to be about Rehana's children because they were the real revolutionaries. They were the people that were fighting in the battles. And then I decided that actually it's a more interesting journey to follow somebody who's not, at first, a kind of natural patriot. You know, she doesn't feel the same things for Bangladesh as her children feel. But it's because she loves her children, she wants to be a part of their struggle, that she sort of slowly gets drawn in. And by the end, she has a completely different relationship to the country than she did in the beginning. And one of the reasons I did that was because, actually, having not grown up in Bangladesh myself, I think some of Rehana's feelings about the place of ambivalence, about not really fitting in, echo some of my own feelings. And to me, that felt like a much more honest place from which to tell the story.
And did you grow up speaking, which language?
Bengali. I did grow up speaking Bengali, although it's very difficult, as you can imagine, because I went to English schools and I, you know, English was the language that I conversed in with my teachers and my friends. It was difficult for my parents to maintain my Bengali. I had Bengali tutors. They spoke to me in Bengali at home all the time. But at this moment, I mean, people in Bangladesh ask me, why didn't you write this book in Bengali? And I have to admit that my Bengali isn't good enough for me to have written a novel. My English is much better than my Bengali.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Tamima Anam about her novel, A Golden Age. It's about a family during the time of the liberation movement of Bangladesh from Pakistan. Now, I wanted to get back to Rehana and her family. She's got two children, an older son, Sohail, and a younger daughter, Maya. She's got a fairly troubled relationship with her daughter. Tell us, why did you portray that? Why is she so much closer to her son? And what are the difficulties with her daughter?
Well, I was thinking about actually my own experience of that culture, of South Asian culture, where because male children are kind of favored in society, women often have these very adoring and very simple relationships with their sons where they just kind of indulge them. And Rehana doesn't really realize that she's done this, but one of her friends points out to her that she's been so much less forgiving of her daughter, and her daughter isn't as easy to love. She's much more brittle and kind of hard, and whereas her son is a very sweet-natured, kind of romantic figure, it's a very unproblematic relationship. He asks her for things, and she can't say no. With her daughter, I think her daughter has more stakes in kind of trying to contradict or overcome the sorts of, you know, traditions that she sees that her mother has not been able to overcome. And so I think that kind of generational gap is much more kind of a parent with a daughter, whereas with the son, it's a much more uncomplicated relationship. So I wanted to explore that a little bit in the novel.
I wanted to ask you for a comment on, there was a review of the book in the Times this past Sunday, and I'd like to just ask you about one part that it puzzled me as well. There's a place in which her daughter Maya talks to her mother about how, you know, all the kids at the university are having sex, mm-hmm. all the women are having sex. And to me, I thought to myself, you know, wow, would somebody in that culture say that to her mother? Mm-hmm. And I guess the reviewer had the same question. So I'm going to ask you to respond to that.
Sure. The thing is, in that moment, Maya has just found out that her friend was raped and that she was raped by a Pakistani soldier. She was kept as a kind of, you know, and this happened during the Bangladesh War. Women were kept as the sexual slaves of the Pakistani soldiers. And there were many kind of rape camps that were discovered. It's a very terrible thing about the war that was only discovered afterwards, and all these women had been kept imprisoned in the army barracks for the months of the war, throughout the 9 months. And Maya's friend died in one of those camps. So partly the reason she says that is because she's so angry, and it's this kind of brutal moment, and she says the most outrageous thing she can think of at that moment. And if you can think back of in times in your life when you're so angry, you just say the worst thing you can think of. And so she says everyone's having sex, but she wasn't. And I think that kind of alludes to the fact that there was a kind of sexual freedom in the 60s that even permeated to a place like Bangladesh. And maybe it's not very comfortable for us to think about, you know, to sort of challenge the notions that we have of that particular society as being quite conservative and very closed. But I do believe, and of course I wasn't there, that some of that consciousness, especially, I mean, certainly the politics that people were talking about, students in the 60s all over the world, was very similar. And there's no reason why the kind of liberties that people took in not necessarily being as sexually free as they were in the West, but certainly talking about these things. And for her, that moment, she wants to utter the most outrageous and kind of dramatic thing she can to her mother because she's so angry. And that's why I put that line in.
So teenagers are the same all over the world, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah.
Tamima, you know, there's a saying that you should be careful about what you wish for because mm-hmm. you may get it, but maybe not how you wanted to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And your novel seems to me to give us a lot of that saying. Rahana is able to keep her family mm-hmm. together mm-hmm. in the end. Her son, Sohail, does become a man. She, I'm not going to say what it is, but mm-hmm. she has a secret, and she's able to release her secret. But in very strange and sometimes tragic ways. Mm-hmm. Tell us, were you aware of that in your writing? What was?
Well, I suppose on a larger scale, I was thinking about all of these people dreaming of a country and really believing that they could create something that was completely new, something that their imaginations were kind of pure because this was a new start for them, a new beginning. And as we know, the last 37 years have not been kind to Bangladesh. We've had many disasters, both man-made and natural. And that's why I called the book A Golden Age, because I think for a lot of people who survived that time, they look back on it. Of course, it was a terrible tragedy, and many, many people lost their lives, and we must never forget that. But for the people who survived it, I think they look back and think, wow, this is really what we wanted. We wanted a new country. And for whatever reasons, many that were beyond their control, many of those hopes were dashed. So I suppose it is a case of careful what you wish for, because this is what they wanted. They wanted their country, and then they had to take responsibility for it, which wasn't very easy.
Mm.
And we're speaking with Tamima Anam about her debut novel, A Golden Age. Now, I wanted to say I found the writing very mature, more mature than in most debut novels, I think. And so did you study writing, or where did this come from?
I did do an MFA in creative writing. The thing about writing school, at least in my experience, is that it's the most unstructured kind of training you can get, because it's all about the response that you get from your peers. And for me, it was an excellent way of really deciding where my stakes were. You know, that I really wanted to write this novel, and this was, and that's from the very first day, that's what I set out to do. And, you know, that was a very wonderful experience. But I have to say, if there are any merits in the book, those merits come from the story that I had to tell. And I feel that, you know, I sort of inherited this story, not just from my family, but from all the people that were so generous in sharing their experiences with me. And all I had to do was kind of find a way to tell it, really. And that was my privilege.
I wanted to ask you another question. Just historically, there's a certain point in the book where Maya goes to Calcutta and her mother joins her there, and they work together in a refugee camp. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about these refugee camps, and there's a very stark experience there. And tell us a little bit about them, and did you draw on some of the stories that you had heard from the people you talked with for this part of the book?
Absolutely. I think the part in Calcutta, the time when they go to the refugee camps, I really had to rely a lot on people's testimonies for that, and also photographs of the camps, which are available in Bangladesh. The scene where it's a field of unused sewer pipes, these giant lengths of pipe that people live in. And I've seen photographs of the camps where people were actually living in those pipes, so that's definitely from kind of documentary evidence. And yes, people, how they got to Calcutta, you know, the train route that Rahana took, that was taken from many people's testimonies of how they got out of Bangladesh and how they smuggled themselves across the border. And, you know, 10 million people fled across the border to India. It was one of the biggest movements of people in history in such a short amount of time. And, of course, this created an immense humanitarian disaster, basically. So that's where I got the information for that part of the story.
And the Hindus were targeted.
Absolutely. Now, you know, the Pakistan Army had to use a particular kind of rhetoric to get the soldiers to commit this brutality on these civilians, because essentially the Bangladesh War was an organized army against a civilian population, a very poorly armed civilian population, which is why the casualty rate was so high. And they told the soldiers, you are fighting a battle for Islam, because this country was, the whole raison d'etre of this country was to have a Muslim country. And if these people want to break away from this Muslim country, they must not be true Muslims. They're doing something against the religion. And therefore, the Hindus were the first people that were targeted. But then even the Muslims were targeted. They were set, you know, they were told, the soldiers were told, these are not real Muslims, so you can kill them. It's not like you're killing your brothers. So there definitely was a very high degree of religious rhetoric during the war.
Tamima, I wonder if you would read a page in your novel to
sure.
us?
Sure. Is there a particular page you had in mind?
There is. Page 130.
130?
Yes, page 130. It's the middle paragraph, starting there, and then just finish the paragraph that ends on page 131.
On days when her nerves threatened to overwhelm her, Rahana tried to think back to a less turbulent time, when nothing of significance happened, when the passing of seasons, the thrill of the Eid moon sighting, the smell of mangoes ripening on the trees, were the most spectacular events of the calendar. But their lives had never had any regularity, at least not the sort Rahana was now sifting her memories for. There was always something, some uproar in the city or beyond, in Islamabad, where one punishing law after another was passed. And even further afield, the death of Che Guevara, who Sohail had mourned as though he had lost a brother. Every hiccup of the political landscape made its way to their door. And when her son was old enough, came through the door and into the bungalow, into the boy's drawn and serious face, the shadows he cast upon the corridors and over the dining table, and then into Maya, who was angrier and louder. No, there had never been any other time. Their lives were populated by Lenin and Castro and Mujib and Anwar Sadat. There was only this time, this life, this fraught and crowded era, to which they were bound without choice, without knowledge, only their passions, their loves, to lead and sustain them.
That's a very beautiful section, and I also thought about how much we all struggle to keep our lives together even when we're not in war, and even more so people who are in war, to maintain the normalcy of their lives. I wonder if you could say just something about, if you could just say more about this passage and kind of what it brought up for you.
Well, actually, this passage refers to the ways in which the people in Bangladesh were connected to the rest of the world in the 60s. And it sort of is connected to what I said before about Maya and her sexuality. You know, we think that the world is moving towards more and more globalization and more connectedness, and that's definitely true. But I think that there was something about that time. There were so many movements for national independence. There was a very big protest against the Vietnam War in this country. And people really felt tied to one another through these struggles and because they were imagining a different world. So really, this passage, and there are some other moments in the book where what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, this is not an isolated country, even though we might think of it that way today because of the poverty and because, you know, all we read about Bangladesh in the papers is about one disaster after another. That at this moment, there was a sense that there was something universal, something shared about the ways in which people were imagining the future.
Well, Tamima Anam, thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
It's also a great pleasure for me. Thanks, Tamima.
Thank you, Michael.
That was Tamima Anam talking with us about her debut novel, a wonderful novel called A Golden Age.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.